trust, lines of code is certainly a proxy for programming effectiveness, but more code is sometimes an inverse signal of productivity, making it a useless measurement for the stated objective. Used with care, proxies can help you measure the immeasurable. Just be sure that your proxy is directly and highly correlated with the subject of your interest. Segmentation. Very often, aggregate datasets contain hidden nuggets of gold, if you can find them. Segmentation is a technique that involves splitting a dataset into well-defined subgroups to add additional context. Splitting the data into predefined groups can uncover previously unknown relationships. For example, knowing that orders increased by 87% this month is good, but knowing that 90% of those new orders came from women in Seattle is even better. Find out what made those women order, and you'll be able to use that information to further capitalize on your success. There are three common ways to segment customer data: past performance, demographics, and psychographics. Past performance segments customers by past known actions. For example, you can segment customer sales data using previous sales data, comparing sales to new customers with sales to customers who have previously purchased from you. Lifetime value calculations are a form of segmentation by past performance. Demographics segment customers by external personal characteristics. Personal information like age, gender, income, nationality, and location can help you determine which customers are your probable purchasers. Knowing that your best customers are males between the age of 23 and 32 who live in major metropolitan areas and have over $2,000 per month in disposable income can be quite useful. You can focus your marketing efforts on reaching more prospects who have those characteristics. Psychographics segment customers by internal psychological characteristics. Typically discovered via surveys, assessments, or focus groups, psychographics are attitudes or worldviews that influence how people see themselves and the world at large. Psychographics can be very useful in creating or adjusting your value creation, marketing, and sales strategies. For example, if you're selling home security systems, it's likely that your probable purchaser will believe statements like, "The world is a dangerous place," and feel somewhat in danger even when in their homes. Experimenting with promoting your product in survivalist and self-defense magazines and websites, markets whose customers might have similar beliefs, might not be a bad idea. Segment your data, and you'll find many useful hidden connections worth investigating. Humanization. Analyzing data is comforting to the quantitative-minded, but to really use data properly, you must go beyond juggling numbers to understand what they're telling you. When analyzing data from a system, it's easy to forget that it often pertains to the actions of real human beings. For example, imagine a customer service department that answers customer complaints by phone. Numerically, reducing hold times from 10 minutes to 8 minutes sounds great. That's a 20% improvement. Put the champagne away. What the data-centric viewpoint misses is the fact that you still have a dissatisfied customer waiting on the phone for 8 minutes, which still feels like an eternity. Every minute on hold makes that customer angrier, which affects their perception of the company. That 20% improvement pales in comparison to the reputation hit your business takes every time that customer tells their friends and associates how horrible your company is to deal with. Humanization is the process of using data to tell a story, a narrative, about a real person's experience or behavior. Quantifiable measures are helpful in aggregate, but it's often necessary to reframe the measure into actual behavior to really understand what's happening. Many businesses humanize by developing a series of personas, fictional profiles of people developed from data. When I developed home cleaning products for P&G, market research data told us that two broad segments existed. People who value deep cleaning and would say something like, "Unless I'm on my hands and knees cleaning with bleach and elbow grease, I'm not satisfied." And people who wanted cleaning to be quick and convenient. They would say, "I'm too busy to clean. As long as it looks good enough, I'm happy." Using this information, we combined these characteristics with other data like household income, family statistics, and hobbies to create a profile of a fictional person. Once the profile was developed, it became easier to use the data we had to make decisions. Instead of relying on statistics to evaluate an idea, we could rely on our intuition by asking ourselves if Wendy would like it. Don't just present data. Tell a story that helps people understand what's happening, and you'll find your analysis efforts more useful. Chapter 11. Improving systems. Creating and improving systems is the heart of successful business practice. The purpose of understanding and analyzing systems is to improve them, which is often tricky. Changing systems can often create unintended consequences. In this chapter, you'll learn the secrets of optimization, how to remove unnecessary friction from critical processes, and how to build systems that can handle uncertainty and change. Intervention bias. Before making a change to a system, it's important to understand that human beings are predisposed to do something rather than nothing. As we discussed, absence blindness leads us to value things we can see over things we can't. This predisposition affects how we work on systems. Intervention bias makes us likely to introduce changes that aren't necessary in order to feel in control of a situation. Many corporate policies have their roots in intervention bias. When something bad happens, it's tempting to try to fix the situation by installing additional layers of limitations, reporting, and auditing. The result isn't an improvement in throughput or efficiency. It's an increase in communication overhead, waste, and unproductive bureaucracy. The best way to correct for intervention bias is to examine what scientists call a null hypothesis, examining what would happen if you did nothing or assumed the situation was an accident or error. Imagine a company that allows its employees to purchase any book they want or need, no questions asked. Books are inexpensive sources of high-quality information, so making it easy for employees to obtain them makes sense. All is well until one employee abuses the privilege and orders hundreds of novels for personal enjoyment. What should be done? Many companies would respond by eliminating the policy and requiring a manager's approval for all book purchases. But this change wouldn't fix the situation because it wasn't a widespread issue. Instead, it would annoy or anger employees who used the privilege responsibly, waste time for everyone by increasing paperwork and bureaucracy, and reduce employee productivity by increasing the amount of time it takes to find information they can use to improve the business. The correct response in this case is to do nothing. One employee has abused the privilege, so the situation can be handled with a single discussion without a major change in policy. The damage is limited, and there's no sense in penalizing everyone for a single person's poor judgment. It's a normal accident, so overreaction is counterproductive. Examining the null hypothesis before intervening will help you avoid intervention bias and ensure you make the best possible decisions. Optimization. Optimization is the process of maximizing the output of a system or minimizing a specific input the system requires to operate. Optimization typically revolves around the systems and processes behind your key performance indicators, which measure the critical elements of the system as a whole. Improve your KPIs, and your system will perform better. Maximization typically focuses on the system's throughput. If you want to earn more money, create more units to sell, or serve more customers, you're optimizing for throughput. Making changes to the system that increase throughput means your system is performing better in a specific, measurable way. Minimization typically focuses on in-process inputs required for the system to operate. If you're trying to increase your profit margin, costs are one of the key inputs. Minimize your costs, and your margins will increase. By definition, if you're trying to maximize or minimize more than one thing, you're not optimizing. You're making trade-offs. Many people use the term optimization to mean making everything better, but that definition doesn't help you actually do anything. In practical terms, trying to optimize for many variables at once doesn't work. You need to be able to concentrate on a single variable for a while, so you can understand how the changes you make affect the system as a whole. You're trying to find causation, not correlation, in your changes, and hidden interdependencies can make it difficult to understand which changes produced which results. Remember, you can't reliably optimize a system's performance across multiple variables at once. Pick the most important one and focus your efforts accordingly. Refactoring. Not all changes to a system are designed to affect the system's output. Sometimes it's more effective to re-engineer a process without changing the end result at all. Refactoring is the process of changing a system to improve efficiency without changing the output of the system. The term comes from computer programming. Programmers will spend hours rewriting a program that, if all goes well, does exactly the same thing when they're finished. What's the point? The primary benefit of refactoring isn't improving the output. It's making the system itself faster or more efficient. By rearranging the processes the system uses to produce the result, it's possible to make the program run faster or require fewer resources while operating. Refactoring starts by deconstructing a process or system, then looking for patterns. What are the critical processes that absolutely must be done right in order to achieve the desired objective? Do these processes have to be completed in a certain order? What are the current constraints? What appears to be particularly important? Collect as much information about how the system works as you can, then sit with it for a while. More often than not, you'll start to notice things about the system that don't make sense, things that you've done a certain way because it seemed like a good idea at the time, but that aren't the best way to approach the task now. Once patterns begin to emerge, you can rearrange the system to group similar processes or inputs together. Think of rearranging an assembly line. If you constantly have to stop what you're doing and travel all the way across the factory to obtain a necessary component, rearranging things so the component is always close at hand is probably a good idea. The system will still produce the same thing when you're done, but you'll have removed a little inefficiency from the system that adds up to significant losses in productivity. If your goal is to make the system faster or more efficient, refactoring is critically important. The critical few. Vilfredo Pareto was a 19th century economist and sociologist who was very interested in the topic of land ownership and the social distribution of wealth. After collecting and analyzing a great deal of data, Pareto found a curious pattern. Over 80% of the land in Italy was owned by less than 20% of the population. The Italian economy wasn't distributed evenly, or in the bell-curved shape distribution many people assumed. Wealth was highly concentrated among a relatively small group of individuals. As Pareto studied other areas of life, he consistently found the same pattern. In Pareto's garden, for example, 20% of the pea pods produced 80% of the peas. What was going on? In any complex system, a minority of the inputs produce the majority of the output. This pattern of persistent nonlinearity is now called the Pareto principle, or the 80-20 rule. Personally, I prefer to refer to it as the critical few. Once you understand this common pattern, you'll find it in many areas of life. For example, in many businesses, less than 20% of the customers account for more than 80% of annual revenue. Less than 20% of a business's employees typically do 80% or more of the highly valuable work. You wear less than 20% of the clothing in your closet over 80% of the time. You spend over 80% of your time communicating with less than 20% of your personal contacts. The nonlinearity of the critical few can often be extreme. For example, less than 3% of the world's population is in possession of over 97% of the world's total wealth. Over time, political power in both countries and companies also tends to concentrate in the hands of a few people, which results in a very small group of individuals making decisions that directly affect the lives of hundreds of millions of people. Far less than 1% of movies ever produced become blockbusters, and less than 0.1% of books ever written become bestsellers. For best results, focus on the critical inputs that produce most of the results you want. In the book, The 4-Hour Workweek, Timothy Ferriss used the critical few to identify his best-performing customers. Out of the 120 customers Ferriss was serving, 5 accounted for 95% of the revenue. By focus on those top-performing wholesalers and putting the rest on autopilot, Ferriss doubled his monthly revenue and cut his work time from 80 hours to 15 hours a week. The same approach is often useful to weed out results you don't want. While conducting his business analysis, Ferriss realized that 2 particular customers accounted for most of his frustration and firefighting. Firing these energy-sucking customers, even though they represented significant sources of volume, liberated his time and energy. As a result, he was able to secure distribution with 3 additional high-volume customers that boosted the bottom line without the constant headaches. Non-critical inputs are significant opportunity costs. If you're spending most of your time in unproductive meetings, for example, you're wasting time that could be used to actually get important things done. The same goes for non-critical expenses. They represent money that you could be using to far greater effect. Find the inputs that produce the outputs you want, then make them the focus of most of your time and energy. Ruthlessly weed out the rest. Diminishing returns. If you have $10 in your bank account, finding $5 in the pocket of your freshly laundered pants is a cause for celebration. If you have $10 million in your bank account, the same situation is a pleasant afterthought. In a similar vein, eating 1 cookie is great. Eating 2 cookies is even better. Eating 100 is actually worse. More is not always better. The same relationship applies to drinking beer and taking vitamins. All good things are subject to diminishing returns. After a certain point, having more of something can actually be detrimental. When I was in marketing at P&G, we spent a lot of time and effort analyzing the results of our advertising. In the first few weeks of running a television commercial, it was easy to see if it was performing as expected. If the commercial was performing well, we'd allocate more money to it, but that would only work for so long. No matter how much people liked the commercial, at a certain point, it would wear out, and the company would no longer produce $1 of revenue for every dollar the company spent showing the ad. That was the point of diminishing returns. If we spent more money showing the same commercial, the company would start losing money. Far better to spend those funds promoting the product in a different way. It's always better to spend a little time and energy to get the big wins than to do nothing. In the book, I Will Teach You to Be Rich, Ramit Sethi recommends applying what he calls the 85% solution. So many people get wrapped up in making the perfect decision that they wind up overwhelming themselves and doing nothing. Focus on doing a few simple things that will produce most of the results you're looking for, then call it a day. Don't feel like you have to optimize absolutely everything to perfection. Optimization and refactoring are affected by the critical few as well. A few small changes can produce enormous results. After you've picked the low-hanging fruit, further optimization can cost more in effort than you'll reap in returns. That's a good point to stop. Perfectionism is a trap for the unwary. Optimize and refactor up to the point you start experiencing diminishing returns, then focus on doing something else. Friction. Imagine a hockey puck on the ground in front of you. You're suitably armed with a hockey stick, and the objective is to move the puck from its present location to the goal, which is located 1 mile away. First, assume the puck is sitting in a field of tall grass, which is waving in the wind. Each whack of the hockey stick will move the puck only a few feet, since the tall grass robs the puck of energy. At this rate, you'll have to hit the puck thousands of times before you get to the goal, and you'll exhaust your energy quickly. It will take you many frustrating hours to reach the goal. Now, let's assume you mow the field until the grass in front of you is very short. Each time you hit the puck, it goes 20 feet or more, a huge improvement. The puck comes in contact with less grass, which means it travels a longer distance with every strike. You'll still have to work to get the puck to the goal, but you'll achieve your objective more quickly and with less effort. Finally, let's assume you flood the field with water and freeze it, until the landscape is a smooth plane of ice. Now, the puck will travel hundreds of feet every time you hit it, because the ice doesn't rob the puck of energy. The puck glides along the surface effortlessly. At this rate, you'll only need to hit the puck a few times before you've achieved the objective, and you won't be tired when you're done. Friction is any force or process that removes energy from a system over time. In the presence of friction, it's necessary to continue to add energy to a system to keep it moving at the same rate over time. Unless additional energy is added, friction will slow the system down until it comes to a stop. Remove the friction, and you'll increase the system's efficiency. Every business process has some amount of friction. The key is to identify areas where friction currently exists, then experiment with small improvements that will reduce the amount of friction in the system. Removing small amounts of friction consistently over time accumulates large improvements in both quality and efficiency. Removing even small amounts of friction from your marketing, sales, and value delivery processes can generate major improvements in profit. For example, retailers like Amazon.com go to enormous lengths to minimize the amount of effort it takes for a customer to place an order. From allowing customers to purchase items with a single click, which automatically charges and ships the order to the customer's default credit card and address on file, to automatically recommending related items for purchase, Amazon aims to make it as easy as possible for its customers to buy online. Amazon Prime, a service that automatically upgrades every order a customer places to two-day shipping, is a textbook example of the benefits of reducing friction. In exchange for a small annual fee, the Prime customers receive their purchases by mail in 2 days or less without spending time in a retail store. When a customer signs up for Amazon Prime, the customer's annual order volume increases by 150% on average, and 82% of Prime members choose to purchase items on Amazon even when the item is less expensive at a competing retailer. As a result, orders from Amazon Prime customers total an estimated 20% of the company's overall U.S. sales, all from finding new ways to reduce friction in the buying process. Introducing friction intentionally can sometimes encourage people to behave in a certain way or make a particular decision. For example, adding a small amount of friction to your returns process, like requiring the customer to provide a receipt or explain the reason for the return, can decrease the number of people who return your product. You don't want to add too much, since that can negatively impact your reputation. Customers get angry if you make them work too hard for a refund. But a little friction in the right place can help prevent frivolous returns. Work on removing friction from your business system where appropriate, and you'll generate better results for less effort. Automation. Remove enough friction, and people may not have to be involved in a process at all. Automation refers to a system or process that can operate without human intervention. Factory production lines, utility networks, and computer programs use automation to minimize the amount of human involvement necessary to complete a task. The less human effort required to operate the system, the more efficient the automation. Automation is best for well-defined, repetitive tasks. For example, if I had to manually reply to a letter or email every time someone wanted to read my list of recommended business books, I'd quickly go insane. Fortunately, I can just put the list up on my website. Every time someone requests the list, it's delivered to them automatically, without any effort on my part. My reading list has been viewed by hundreds of thousands of readers from around the world, and automation is what makes it possible. Find a way to automate your system, and you open the doors to scale via duplication and multiplication, improving your ability to create and deliver value to more paying customers. The paradox of automation. Automation can be great, but it has very important drawbacks worth understanding. Imagine a fully automated production line that makes computer processors that sell for $200 per unit. All the human operators have to do is push a button, and the production system starts cranking out 2,400 finished products per minute. Life is good, right? Yes, with a very important caveat. Imagine that a drill used to bore holes in the silicon wafer becomes misaligned and starts drilling microscopic holes through the middle of the processor core. Every second the system keeps working, 40 chips are ruined. Assume each processor costs $20 in raw materials. That means the factory starts losing $800 every second the error isn't found. Every minute the system keeps running, the company loses $48,000. And that's just the direct cost. If you take into account that each processor would sell for $200, the company is losing $528,000 a minute, $48,000 in direct costs, and $480,000 in opportunity costs. Sound far-fetched? Consider this. In late 2009, Toyota identified a major issue with the accelerator pedal in several popular vehicle models, which were top sellers for many years. The error was multiplied across every vehicle Toyota made, and the recall cost over $5 billion. Before the recall, Toyota was considered the best automotive manufacturer in the world. They still are in many respects, but their reputation and financial situation suffered a major blow. Even the best can fall if costly mistakes are allowed to multiply. Here's the paradox of automation. The more efficient the automated system, the more crucial the contribution of human operators to that system. When an error happens, operators need to identify and fix the situation quickly or shut the system down. Otherwise, the automated system will continue to multiply the error. Dr. Lisant Bainbridge, a psychologist at University College London, was one of the first to rigorously study the ramifications of efficient and reliable systems. She was the first to identify and express the paradox of automated systems. Efficient automated systems reduce the need for human effort, but make human involvement even more critical. Efficient automation makes humans more important, not less. The irony of automation. Efficient automated systems make skilled human intervention critically important to prevent the amplification of errors, so it's best to keep skilled operators on hand at all times, right? That's easier said than done. Businesses typically don't pay highly skilled employees to sit around in a room all day doing nothing, which is what they'll be doing as long as the system appears to be reliable. Even if they do, the operators will spend most of their time being bored out of their skulls. Here's the irony of automation. The more reliable the system, the less human operators have to do, so the less they pay attention to the system while it's in operation. Remember the Mackworth clock and the vigilance studies conducted on British radar operators in World War II from our discussion of novelty? Humans get bored extremely quickly if things stay the same, and the more reliable the system, the more things stay the same. Ironically, reliable systems tend to dull the operator's senses, making it very difficult for them to notice when things go wrong, the moment when their attention is most sorely needed. As a result, the more reliable the system, the lower the likelihood that human operators will notice when something goes wrong, particularly if the error is small. Left long enough, small errors can become the new normal, which is how a company like Toyota ends up with a $5 billion recall. By the way, don't make the attribution error and think that Toyota's engineers were stupid or careless. If you rely on automated systems, it could easily happen to you. The best approach to avoid major automation errors is rigorous, ongoing sampling and testing. Remember, normal accidents can and will occur. If you assume that errors will be made and plan a battery of tests to find the most critical errors, you can keep your system operators engaged and increase the probability of finding important errors quickly. Keep your automated systems operators mentally engaged, and they'll be far more likely to notice when errors inevitably occur. Standard operating procedure. What do you do when a customer has a complaint or asks for a refund? What happens when you run out of toner for the laser printer? Who takes the helm if the manager is out of town and there's an emergency? A standard operating procedure, abbreviated SOP, is a predefined process used to complete a task or resolve a common issue. Business systems often include repetitive tasks, and having a standard process in place can help you spend less time reinventing the wheel and more time doing productive work. Well-defined standard operating procedures are useful because they reduce friction and minimize willpower depletion. Instead of wasting valuable time and energy solving a problem that has already been solved many times before, a predefined SOP ensures that you spend less time thrashing and more time adding value. Standard operating procedures are also effective ways to bring new employees or partners up to speed quickly. Having a central source of SOPs can help new employees or partners learn how you work far more effectively than informal training. Storing your SOPs in some sort of central electronic database is best. It ensures that everyone can instantly reference the most up-to-date procedures available. Don't let your standard operating procedures lapse into bureaucracy. Remember, the purpose of an SOP is to minimize the amount of time and effort it takes to complete a task or solve a problem effectively. If the SOP requires effort without providing value, it's friction. For best results, review your SOPs on a periodic basis. Once every 2 to 3 months is ideal. If you find outdated, wasteful, or unnecessary work in your SOPs, change them. Neither you nor your customers are served by unnecessary red tape. Create standard operating procedures for important recurring tasks, and you'll see your productivity skyrocket. Checklists. Want to make sure an important task is done correctly every single time? Create a checklist. A checklist is an externalized, predefined standard operating procedure for completing a specific task. Creating a checklist is enormously valuable for two reasons. First, checklisting will help you define a system for a process that hasn't yet been formalized. Once the checklist has been created, it's easier to see how to improve or automate the system. Second, using checklists as a normal part of working can help ensure that you don't forget to handle important steps that are easily overlooked when things get busy. Pilots have extremely detailed checklists for takeoff and landing for a reason. Skipping a step is easy, but can have major consequences for everyone on board. Even pilots with decades of flying experience always use checklists to make sure everything is done right and in the proper sequence. As a result, plane crashes are extremely rare. Statistically, it's safer to fly commercially than to drive. Even simple processes can benefit from systemization and the use of checklists. In 2001, a study on the effects of checklisting was conducted by Dr. Peter Provenost, which was described in detail in Atul Gawande's The Checklist Manifesto and in an article Gawande published in The New Yorker. The study was conducted in a hospital in Detroit that had the highest rate of 10-day IV line infections in the country. Provenost's objective was to determine whether or not using checklists would reduce the rate of infections. Here's the entirety of the intervention. Whenever a doctor inserted an IV line, they were instructed to use the following checklist. Step 1. Wash hands with soap. Step 2. Clean the patient's skin with chlorhexidine antiseptic. Step 3. Put sterile drapes over the entire patient. Step 4. Wear a sterile hat, mask, gloves, and gown. Step 5. Put a sterile dressing over the catheter site once the IV line is in. None of these steps is particularly complicated. In fact, many doctors resisted the study since they felt that being forced to use a checklist for such a simple procedure was insulting, given their status as highly trained specialists. Even more insulting, the head nurse was empowered to stop the doctor if they weren't using the checklist, an unusual role reversal that had many doctors fuming. Nevertheless, the results of this study over 2 years were astonishing. The 10-day IV line infection rate dropped from 11% to 0% and saved the hospital over $2 million in related costs. As it turns out, forgetting even basic common sense procedures is easy in a busy, stressful environment. Checklisting can produce major improvements in your ability to do quality work, as well as your ability to delegate work effectively. By taking the time to explicitly describe and track your progress, you reduce the likelihood of major errors and oversights, as well as prevent willpower depletion associated with figuring out how to complete the same task over and over again. In addition, once your checklist is complete, you can use it as the basis for full or partial automation of the system, which will allow you to spend time doing more important things. For best results, create explicit checklists for the five parts of your business, then make sure they're followed every single time. Cessation. Sometimes the best way to improve a system is to stop doing so much. Cessation is the choice to intentionally stop doing something that's counterproductive. Due to absence blindness, we are predisposed to attempt to improve a system by doing something. It feels wrong to do nothing. That doesn't mean that doing nothing is a bad strategy. It's often more effective. In the book, The One Straw Revolution, Manasobu Fukuoka wrote about his experiments with natural farming, which mostly involved letting nature take its course and intervening as little as possible. While most farms were introducing chemicals and machinery into agriculture, Fukuoka was consciously doing nothing and reaping the rewards of high yields and ever-increasing soil richness. Here's what he had to say about the virtues of cessation, and I quote, "Human beings with their tampering do something wrong, leave the damage unrepaired, and when the adverse results accumulate, work with all their might to correct them. When the corrective actions appear to be successful, they come to view these measures as splendid accomplishments. People do this over and over again. It's as if a fool were to stomp on and break the tiles of his roof. Then, when it starts to rain and the ceiling begins to rot away, he hastily climbs up to mend the damage, rejoicing in the end that he has accomplished a miraculous solution." End quote. Instead of trying to do too much, Fukuoka did only what was absolutely necessary. As a result, his fields were consistently among the most productive in the area. Cessation takes guts. It's often unpopular or unpalatable to do nothing, even if doing nothing is actually the right solution. As an example, pricing bubbles are often caused by government intervention in certain markets, which has the second-order effect of artificially decreasing the costs of certain actions, leading to rampant speculation. When reality sets in and the bubble pops, as it did with dot-com companies in 2000 and the housing market in 2008, it's politically unpopular for the government to do nothing, even though doing something is what caused the situation in the first place. More often than not, the government acts, which causes another, bigger bubble a few years later. Firing customers, quitting your job, discontinuing a product, or pulling out of a market you can't succeed in are all tough decisions, but these decisions may put you in a better position in the long run. Doing something is not always the best course of action. Consider doing nothing instead. Resilience. Turtles aren't the sexiest creatures in the animal kingdom. They can't run fast. They can't fly. They don't have big sharp teeth or claws. They can't puff themselves up to look menacing or poison their enemies with deadly venom. Compared to the raw power of a tiger or a falcon, turtles are rather lame. What turtles do have is a variety of protective strategies. They can swim quickly, use camouflage, snap with their jaws, and if all else fails, retract into their shell and wait for the threat to pass. Creatures elsewhere in the animal kingdom are in big trouble if they're cornered by a predator. Turtles have a fighting chance. They win because they're the armored tanks of nature. They can also eat many different things and go into hibernation when times get tough. That's why they live so long. Tigers, on the other hand, rely on their strength, power, and speed to chase down their prey. When times are good, tigers are kings of the jungle. If prey becomes scarce, or they lose their hunting prowess due to age or injury, death takes them quickly and mercilessly. No second chances. What the business world needs is more turtles and fewer tigers. The world is a fundamentally uncertain place. Unexpected things happen, some good, some bad. You never know when Mother Nature, Lady Luck, or a hungry predator will decide that today is not your day. Resilience is a massively underrated quality in business. Having the toughness and flexibility to handle anything life throws at you is a major asset that can save your skin, literally and metaphorically. Your ability to adjust your strategy and tactics as conditions change can be the difference between survival and disaster. Resilience is never optimal if you evaluate a system solely on throughput. Flexibility always comes at a price. A turtle's shell is heavy. It could certainly move faster without it. Giving it up, however, would leave the turtle vulnerable in the moments when moving a little faster just isn't fast enough. In an effort to chase a few more short-term dollars, many businesses trade resilience for short-term results and pay a hefty price. The big investment banks are a classic example. Keeping cash reserves on hand to handle the unexpected has become called ultra-conservative and inefficient. It's become a best practice to leverage the entire company many times over to squeeze out a few more cents in earnings per share each quarter, leaving the business explosively vulnerable to a very small decline in revenues. Operating a business with no cash reserves, no insurance, and high levels of debt may improve your returns for a few months or quarters. But the moment your revenues decline by even a little, or someone decides to sue the business, you're sunk. Leverage works just like rocket fuel. Depending on how it's used, it can propel your business to dizzying heights or make the entire operation explode. Unfortunately, many of the advanced financial manipulation tactics taught in business schools implicitly trade resilience for paper returns, and once successful businesses pay the price by going out of business when times get tough. Preparing for the unexpected makes you more resilient. On a personal level, investing in a home emergency and first aid kit, car kit, and extra resources like food and water isn't paranoid. Supplies like these are cheap insurance for the intelligent. The same goes for purchasing insurance and building up reserves for unexpected events. You may never need them, but you'll be glad they're there if you do. Here's what makes a business resilient. Low, preferably zero, outstanding debt. Low overhead, fixed costs, and operating expenses. Substantial cash reserves for unexpected contingencies. Multiple independent products, industries, and lines of business. Flexible workers and employees who can handle many responsibilities well. No single points of failure, and fail-safes or backup systems for all core processes. Planning for resilience as well as performance is the hallmark of good management. Resilience is certainly not sexy, mostly because the benefits suffer from absence blindness. It can, however, save your hide when times get tough. Think less like a tiger and more like a turtle, and your business will be able to withstand pretty much anything. Failsafe. Every Wednesday at noon, a generator kicks on outside of the house I grew up in. If all goes well, it'll run for 10 minutes, then turn off automatically until the next testing cycle, silently waiting to spring into action again when the power goes out. My father once worked as a firefighter and emergency medical technician and has refined being prepared into a high art. The generator is designed to turn on automatically the moment the primary electricity to the house fails, taking over the house's electrical demands seamlessly. The generator is fed via a propane tank behind the garage, which has enough fuel to keep the generator running for a week. If a storm knocks out power to the area, Dad is prepared to handle it. Dad's preparedness rubbed off on me. Now that we live in the mountains of Colorado, we have to be prepared for the possibility of our cars breaking down somewhere remote or cold, and we can't rely on AAA, or cell phone coverage, to save us. Kelsey often makes fun of me for stocking our vehicles with extra clothing, sleeping bags, snowshoes, and satellite-driven personal locator beacons, but I don't mind. If something happens, we'll be glad we were prepared. I consider the investment in equipment a cheap, durable insurance policy. A failsafe is a backup system designed to prevent or allow recovery from a primary system failure. If the primary system fails in some way, well-designed failsafes can keep the system from collapsing unexpectedly. You can find backup systems anywhere consistent performance is critical. Actors in high-profile Broadway shows have understudies. If the show must go on, it pays to know you'll always have a replacement for any actor who can't perform. Most shows even have a few swing actors, performers who are ready to stand in for any role at a moment's notice. External hard drives back up critical computer data. If the hard drive in your computer crashes, you can still access the data via the backup drive, so you won't lose everything. Some businesses even take the precaution of storing backup drives off-site in case of fire or natural disaster. Airplanes have systems that sense a failure in cabin pressure, automatically deploying face masks attached to an oxygen tank. If the airplane's pressurized cabin fails for some reason, the passengers won't lose consciousness. A very good thing indeed. Failsafes are not efficient in the sense that you're investing time and resources in a system you hope you'll never use. Backup systems and insurance, from one perspective, can be seen as a waste of money. Why spend valuable resources on something you hope you'll never need? Here's why. By the time you need a failsafe, it's too late to develop one. In order to be effective, failsafes must be developed before you need them. If you wait to develop backup systems until you need them, it's too late to make a difference. Paying for homeowners insurance can feel like a waste of money until your house burns down. If you wait to buy insurance until something bad happens, it's already too late. Try to separate your failsafe and primary system as much as possible. One of the reasons people rent safe deposit boxes in banks is to protect certain items from loss in the event of fire or theft. If something happens to the house, the items in the safe deposit box will still be okay. The practice of backing up data to an off-site data center serves the same purpose. If something happens to the business's primary computers, the data is still safe in another location. Failsafes that are highly interdependent with the primary system can actually introduce additional risks. One of the worst things you can do is make your backup system a part of the system you're trying to protect. For example, it wouldn't do my father much good if a failure in the generator cascaded to the house's primary electrical system and knocked out the power unexpectedly. An automated computer backup doesn't do you any good if it could potentially delete all of your original files. As much as possible, never have a single critical point of failure. If your system relies on critical inputs or processes in order to function, it's a good idea to plan for situations where those inputs aren't available or those processes are disrupted. What would you do if your primary system fails? Plan in advance to develop failsafes for all critical systems, and you'll make your system as resilient as you possibly can. Stress testing. Let's say you've developed what you believe is a robust, resilient system, but you want to ensure that your preparations actually work. How would you go about testing it? Stress testing is the process of identifying the boundaries of a system by simulating specific environmental conditions. Instead of staying in systems engineer mode, stress testing inverts your mindset into what I call demon mode. What would it take to break what you've built? In the early days of the personal MBA, every time I launched a new version of the reading list, my web server would go down in a blaze of glory. The system couldn't keep up with all of the people trying to visit the website. I upgraded to several different systems, but each time, it wasn't enough. I continued having server issues until I got serious about stress testing. Instead of waiting for an influx of traffic that would cause my site to go down, I set about breaking my system intentionally, then trying different approaches to make the system more resilient under stress. Using an automated tool, I simulated a huge number of visitors hitting my website at the same time. The tool continuously increased the number of visitors requesting my website, then tracked how long my website took to respond. As the requests went up, my site's performance decreased until the server failed. Using the data I collected from the stress test, I made several major improvements to my website's infrastructure and systems. Now, thousands of people can visit my site at precisely the same moment without noticeably affecting performance. A huge improvement. Stress tests can help you learn more about how your system works. If you're in the manufacturing business, you could simulate a sudden order of thousands of units. Can you keep up? If you're doing customer support, you could simulate a massive influx of questions or complaints. Could you handle it? Your ability to test is only limited by your available time and imagination. Let your inner demon run wild then fix any major problems you find before they affect real customers. Scenario planning. As we've discussed many times in this book, no one can predict what will happen tomorrow, let alone 10 years from now. That's a problem when your plans and goals depend on things completely outside of your locus of control. What can you do to prepare for an uncertain future? Scenario planning is the process of systematically constructing a series of hypothetical situations, then mentally simulating what you would do if they occurred. You may not be a seer, but counterfactual simulation gives you a powerful capability, imagining things that might occur, then figuring out what you'd do if they did. Scenario planning is essentially detailed, thorough, and systematic counterfactual simulation applied to major decisions. Scenario planning always starts with a simple question. What would I do if? The what if part is the counterfactual, and it's what kicks your planning brain into gear, helping you imagine possible responses. By writing down all of your potential courses of action in that circumstance, it's possible to develop several responses to any situation you can imagine. Scenario planning is the essence of effective strategy. Trying to base your actions on predictions of interest rates, oil prices, or stock values is a fool's game. Instead of trying to predict the future with 100% accuracy, scenario planning can help you prepare for many different possible futures. Instead of rigidly focusing on only one option, your business will become more flexible and resilient, improving your ability to change and adapt to a changing world. Most large businesses use scenario planning as the basis of a practice called hedging, purchasing various forms of insurance to reduce the risk of unfavorable future events. For example, manufacturers care about oil prices because they increase the cost of importing raw materials and shipping finished products to their customers, both of which can suddenly and dramatically decrease their profit margins. By purchasing financial instruments called futures, the businesses can make money if the price of oil goes up, which helps to offset the losses they would incur if oil prices increase. Scenario planning is easy to skip, particularly if you already have a lot of work to do. The time you spend in scenario planning can be some of the most valuable time you spend building your business, but it's easy to overlook if you're constantly struggling to simply keep your head above water. Regularly setting non-negotiable time to step back and plan for the future is always time well spent. Don't skip it. Don't waste time trying to predict an unknowable future. Construct the most likely scenarios and plan what you'll do if they occur, and you'll be prepared for whatever actually happens. The sustainable growth cycle. It's a mistake to assume any system can grow indefinitely, without limit. Systems tend to have a natural size, and exceeding this size can cause many problems. Elements of a system that are out of control need to be eliminated. Take cell growth, for example. The cells in your body tend to grow to a certain size and to multiply at a rate that ensures new cells replace cells that die. When these proportions are in balance, your body works quite well. When cells grow or multiply out of control, the situation can threaten the existence of the system. Cancerous cells need to be removed to ensure the health of the entire body. Businesses and biological systems have many things in common. They're made up of many interrelated parts and systems that change and grow over time. If the five parts of every business grow out of control or out of proportion to each other, the situation can threaten the health of the organization. The sustainable growth cycle is a pattern I've noticed in businesses that are able to grow year after year without major difficulties. This cycle has three distinct phases: expansion, maintenance, and consolidation. In an expansion phase, the company is focused on growing. New offers are created and tested. New markets are explored. New business units are built and staffed, and future plans are created. Early data about what works is collected for later use. In a maintenance phase, the company is focused on executing the current plan. The marketing, sales, and value delivery parts of the business are in full swing, and emphasis is placed on fully exploring the potential of the current business structure. Systems are put in place to ensure the execution. In a consolidation phase, the company is focused on analysis. Information about the performance of the business is examined in detail in an attempt to figure out what's working and what's not. Things that aren't working are cut back or eliminated, and things that are working are given more resources. Think of plant cultivation. The best gardeners allow plants to grow, ensure they have enough resources to thrive, then cut back the plants that don't. This cycle repeats season after season. Every cycle is essential. Many entrepreneurs become frustrated when their business seems to hit a plateau and growth appears to stop. Spending time on maintenance or consolidation seems like a waste or a flaw in the business idea. That's not the case at all. These phases are necessary to ensure the business succeeds, and they should be respected. A business that fixates on expansion but shortchanges maintenance and consolidation will experience the commercial equivalent of cancerous growth. Parts of the business will grow out of control, consuming too much time, energy, and resources compared to what they contribute to the health of the business. New opportunities will be explored while proven opportunities are ignored or forgotten. Maintenance and consolidation are necessary to bring the system into balance. Once the system is humming along, the growth cycle kicks in automatically. A healthy business cycles between expansion, maintenance, and consolidation often. No matter which part of the cycle you're in, it's important to recognize that it's necessary and essential to the health of your business. By giving each cycle the appropriate time and attention, you'll ensure the long-term success of the business. The middle path. Business is never easy. It's an art as much as a science. The middle path is the ever-changing balance point between too little and too much, just enough. No one can tell you what the middle path is. You have to be walking the path to know, and it changes constantly. Getting the balance right in the midst of uncertainty is the difference between a competent business professional and a great one. The best approach to anything almost always lies somewhere between too little and too much. Just as in cooking, business recipes can only teach you so much. You may know the ingredients, the techniques, and the tools, but actually cooking a dish still requires attention, effort, and taste. No one has it all figured out. No one is absolutely certain that something will work, or has a complete lack of fear that things won't work out as planned. The people who experience the most success in this world are the people who accept the uncertainty and fear as best they can, learn from their experiences, and keep trying new things. Try to find the middle path, then stay on it as best you can. Find the right balance, and you can accomplish anything. The experimental mindset. When improving yourself or your business, it's often not clear what approach will create the intended result. That's where the experimental mindset comes in handy. Constant experimentation is the only way you can identify what will actually produce the result you desire. Often, the best, or only, way to learn things is to jump in and try. At the beginning, you may be in over your head, but there's no faster way to learn what works. Once you're committed to exploring something, you'll learn far more quickly than if you'd cowered on the sidelines. You learn the most from what doesn't go well. As long as your mistakes don't kill you, paying attention to what doesn't work can give you useful information you can use to discover what does. All failures are temporary. What you learn in the process always helps you move forward. Experimentation is learning through play. There's no need to build yourself up as a quote-unquote serious business person who cringes at the thought of the slightest mistake. You'll make thousands of mistakes over the course of your career, and that's perfectly okay. Every experiment teaches you something new, and every new lesson you learn increases your capability to accomplish great things. Experimentation is the essence of living a satisfying, productive, fulfilling life. The more you experiment, the more you learn, and the more you'll achieve. Not the end. Many of my readers and clients ask me, "This business education stuff is great, but when will I be done?" Wrong question, Grasshopper. Self-education, whether it's about business or anything else, is a never-ending process. There's never a point where you'll say, okay, I'm done. No more learning for me. Every new concept you come across is a gateway to thousands of other opportunities for exploration. That's what makes self-education so fun and rewarding. There's always something new to learn. In Eastern philosophy, Tao means way or path, a journey you're in the process of undertaking. Tao has no beginning and no end. It just is. Educating yourself about anything is a Tao. There's no end to the process. The journey itself is the reward. Even masters of the art of money-making like Warren Buffett are always looking for new things to learn. When asked in an interview with students from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln about what superpowers he'd like to have, Buffett answered, "I'd like to be able to read faster." Most of what Buffett does on a daily basis is read financial reports and learn new concepts, looking for new ways to increase the value of his company. Even the wealthiest person on earth has things to improve and more to explore. That ongoing curiosity is what made them successful in the first place. There will certainly be milestones along your path, completing a book, mastering a new skill, launching a business, and closing a sale. Eventually, however, you'll find that there's a new path for you to take, and the journey continues. There's never a limit to how much you can grow. Now that you've listened to this book, please visit personalmba.com and subscribe to the Personal MBA email update. I revise my recommended reading list every year and publish new material every month. There's no cost, and I'd be happy to keep you up to date with the most useful business information I discover. I'd like to leave you with a few words of wisdom from B.C. Forbes, the founder of Forbes magazine, who wrote an essay in 1917 called Keys to Success. I refer to it often and find that it's a great reminder of what business and life are all about. And I quote, "Your success depends on you. Your happiness depends on you. You have to steer your own course. You have to shape your own fortune. You have to educate yourself. You have to do your own thinking. You have to live with your own conscience. Your mind is yours and can be used only by you. You come into this world alone. You go to the grave alone. You are alone with your inner thoughts during the journey between. You make your own decisions. You must abide by the consequences of your acts. You alone can regulate your habits and make or unmake your health. You alone can assimilate things mental and things material. You have to do your own assimilation all through life. You can be taught by a teacher, but you have to imbibe the knowledge. He cannot transfuse it into your brain. You alone can control your mind cells and your brain cells. You may have spread before you the wisdom of the ages, but unless you assimilate it, you can derive no benefit from it. No one can force it into your cranium. You alone can move your own legs. You alone can move your own arms. You alone can utilize your own hands. You alone can control your own muscles. You must stand on your feet, physically and metaphorically. You must take your own steps. Your parents cannot enter into your skin, take control of your mental and physical machinery, and make something of you. You cannot fight your son's battles. That he must do for himself. You have to be captain of your own destiny. You have to see through your own eyes. You have to use your own ears. You have to master your own faculties. You have to solve your own problems. You have to form your own ideals. You have to create your own ideas. You must choose your own speech. You must govern your own tongue. Your real life is your thoughts. Your thoughts are your own making. Your character is your own handiwork. You alone can select the materials that go into it. You alone can reject what is not fit to go in it. You are the creator of your own personality. You can be disgraced by no man's hand but your own. You can be elevated and sustained by no man but yourself. You have to write your own record. You have to build your own monument or dig your own pit. Which are you doing?" End quote. I hope you've enjoyed this book and found it useful. If you have, please spread the word. If you have questions or comments, don't hesitate to reach out. You can always contact me directly at josh@personalmba.com. Thanks for listening, and best wishes on your journey through the fascinating and ever-changing world of business. Have fun.